A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast.
We're back again.
Episode 2, Season 3.
Last week's episode was amazing, Andrew. Dr. Nasser Siabi.
Yeah, it's interesting doing these podcasts because every time I go away after a podcast, my mind just goes on epic level of thinking about it all. And the more I thought about it, I just thought what a talented guy he really was.
Yeah, that whole assisted technology in and around helping disabled and neurodiverse people in the workplace, that's some amazing stuff he's doing.
Yeah, and obviously as technology increases, it's just going to get just better and better. It's just amazing.
Wait, we've got heavy into this fast. How are you doing? What's been going on?
I'm good. This is not normal.
Where's our banter gone? Our chit-chat? We are straight in the deep end today.
I've gone off you a bit, James. That's why.
It's because we've not been hanging out for 5 months. This week on the podcast, you chatted to fellow dyslexic John Hammond.
Yes. What an exciting guy. So John messaged me and asked to come on the show. And I not many people know this, but I am an Amazon nut. And when I found out, woof.
So John is head of compute for UK and Ireland at AWS or Amazon Web Services. Mm-hmm. He's had an extraordinary career from an A-level in computer science at 12 years old. Mm. He built the London Stock Exchange?
Yeah, he was on the team.
Sorry, I was just reading the notes here and I thought that it had been mistyped.
No, he was on the team that built the London Stock Exchange.
As you do. Yeah. And then he's worked in some significant senior roles at places like Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs.
I was really nervous about meeting John because most people don't know this. I'm a bit of an Amazon nut and, you know, it was really exciting.
In this episode, you speak to John about why being dyslexic has made challenges easier for him. Mm-hmm. You discuss the worrying lack of young people picking computer science.
Yes.
And you also discuss one of my favourite topics, which is the importance of failure.
Yes. So me and John are on the same page with that, and it was really great. As always, when I meet people that feel the same as me, and yeah, the amount of times he failed to get where he is now and myself, it's just great. It really pushes you.
Understanding being comfortable with failure can be so freeing. But first, let's learn a bit more about John and what school was like for him.
Let's take a listen. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. My name is John Hammond. I run compute for Amazon Web Services for the UK. And then I run a bunch of other businesses for us, EMEA-wide. Grew up not too far from here in Greenford in a modest area would be probably the really nice way of putting it.
It's funny, you've completely undersold yourself. Fuck, Jesus. Connor gave me, so Connor, our wonderful producer, does all the research for us, and he gave me, and on the way to every podcast, I do my own research anyway, but I get my PA to read out who I'm meeting. And I was like, she read all the research that Connor done on you, and I was like, No. That's not one person. There's no way that's one person. She was like, this is all John. So you have had a very interesting career.
Yeah.
So from So let me get this right, because I know you're obviously a modest man. So let me try and help you out here. You are neurodiverse, right?
I am. So I'm pretty extremely dyslexic, I would say, which is good. Which for me, I've kind of got to this weird bit in life where it feels like I'm not cheating at stuff, but this is what I mean. Honestly, I've loved listening to bits of your podcast so much, because for me, I've managed to come to a position where I now seem to just have the good bits of dyslexia and the bad bits, which I did. I had loads of challenges, loads of struggles over the years. But I've kind of managed to deal with those to such a degree, they just cause no issue. They don't even register. And, you know, I'm kind of the same as you. I'm quite proud of the fact I'm dyslexic now, which is fantastic, because, you know, I'll not necessarily lead conversations with it, but pretty quickly I'll often say I'm dyslexic. And for me, it's this fantastic example, advantage, sorry, where I genuinely think different about things, and that's just really, really lucky.
So in your past, you've kind of gone through, from the research that you've kind of gone through, and it seemed like bad, oh, sorry, for us, typical. And then suddenly you went, right, I'm going to go do this. So give us a quick brief after school and then work.
I mean, I can give you from the beginning. So, I found it quite hard to read when I was young. Mm-hmm. I got, as weird as it sounds, I think a lot of, and I think you find with some successful dyslexics, they find one thing and they pick up on it.
Hmm.
I was very, very lucky, because I found something when I was very young that I could pick up. And, you know, if I'd picked up football, it'd be fantastic. But, you know, there comes a limit when I might not be a footballer. But I managed to pick up on computing, and I picked that up from such an early age that I've continued that through. And what's weird for me is I've kind of resulted in more years of experience than I should be able to have. It's probably the best way of putting it. So I, you know, many, many moons ago, got a bit better. My uncle basically saw that I was kind of interested in computing, gave me a BBC Micro, which I had when I was three, and I started trying to code on it as a three-year-old child, which is, I mean, it was only basic, like, hello world, print what your name is. So started doing that really, really young. But then what was weird for me is all through those early years, as much as I could do pretty much anything on a computer, but I couldn't really write particularly well. I mean, I couldn't spell my own name till I was 11, 12, which, I mean, I call myself John now. My full name is Jonathan Stephen Hammond, which I think is almost the worst name you can give to a dyslexic person, because it's overly long. It's difficult to work out. Did my GCSE computer science when I was 11. So I did that when I still couldn't spell my name, got an A in that. Did my A-level computer science when I was 13, which was pretty good. So got an A in that, which was weird. Went to a night school with loads of adults and basically me as a child in the class. Got to GCSEs, you know, very, very keen, very good at stuff, kind of towards GCSEs. Started to realise I was dyslexic at that point, which my dad was. My dad's a fantastic, I mean, my dad's done all kinds of fantastic stuff, and he's a real inspiration to me. But he had the same issues. So he started out, he left school at 11. He went into a neon sign factory. I think he was basically told that he was stupid, sadly. But then if you look through his career, he kind of did interesting things as well. So he ended up being a prototype wireman at Thorny MI. He wired the first ever body scan, or the first ever MRI scan, which is, as someone who's really severely dyslexic, it's kind of amazing. I found I went through into GCSEs, found stuff really hard, if I'm honest. And then from 16 to probably about 26, I didn't do very well, would be probably fair to say. I started, it sounds very random, but I started dating a girl who probably wasn't the best, my mum didn't think she was a good influence on me. My mum was probably right. So went through, did that. And then at 26, basically, I started dating a new girl who's now mother to my three children, amazingly. And she kind of said, like, what the fuck have you been doing, basically? Like, you could obviously see that you were good at things at first. And then I just made a point of trying to do the hardest things I could possibly do, really. So then went on, ended up being the lead architect, one of the lead architects on the London Stock Exchange. So built the UK Stock Exchange, which is really cool.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's amazing. Like, you don't almost, I'd say to people on the weekend that there's a problem with it and we're restarting it. And we'd literally, you know, we were restarting the Stock Exchange. We managed to optimize that so it was you know, could do thousands of trades in the blink of an eye. So we built the fastest one that ever existed. So that was pretty cool. And then went on. So I got very into to low latency trading. So in the same way that you see these books like Flash Boys, where they're about these kind of, not necessarily terrible, but these finance people who are doing all these quick trades, I built loads of the IT behind it. So I went to work at Deutsche Bank. I was running about a third of all the world's foreign exchange was going through the system that we made. Did that. Went to, had a kind of career in FS. So went over to Goldman Sachs, ran loads of their low latency, loads of the trading for all of Europe, ran loads of things for Credit Suisse, so this kind of DevOps-y stuff. And then went over to Standard Chartered and ran the infrastructure team for Standard Chartered globally for a bit. And then I kind of moved about a bit, did that, went to the world of consulting, so ran cloud and DevOps for a large consultancy for Europe, and then managing director at Accenture, and now into Amazon running like quite a large chunk of their UK computing business, which is really fun.
And what some listeners probably don't know is AWS is becoming a force of nature at the moment, isn't it?
It's crazy.
I think at one point, funnily enough, my wife actually applied for a job on it, because it was like 42,000 something silly job opportunities at that alone. It was insane.
It's amazing. I mean, if you took it at its own company, I think it's somewhere in the region of $42-50 billion a year. It is huge. It's absolutely huge. I mean, every time, it's one of these weird things I have to explain to people what it is, but every time you use, you know, Netflix or iPlayer you know, you're basically using all that, or go onto most shopping set sites.
Yeah.
You're just using the compute that I've helped build, which is kind of cool.
That is cool. Funnily enough, when you contacted me about coming on the show, I was like, I honestly, you're right. I don't think many people know what it is, but I always say to people when they talk about, because everyone loves Amazon. I've never met anyone that doesn't love Amazon, but everyone thinks about the delivery service and the shopping part of it. But there's so much more to Amazon. And I said, people using it every day and don't know they're using it. And that must be unbelievable to be part of a company like that.
I mean, it's really fun. And then I think where I'm kind of lucky, I've got into this really interesting piece of it. So I basically build new businesses. So at the moment I'm building things around some of autonomous vehicles, doing a lot of things with quantum computing. And I think where I've got to a really fun part, and I think where actually my dyslexia comes into its own, is I'm really good at being thrown into circumstances that you can't know the right answer to, it as weird as it sounds. Because no one's, I mean, and so much actually, I think, of the interesting bits of business, no one has done before. You just kind of need to have sense, and you need to work it out, and you need to kind of go from, you know, the start of it and work out how you go forward. And I think in a weird way, because I found everything else so hard, it means that everything's hard. So I don't find anything easy. So in a weird way, it's all as equally hard, which kind of is an easy way to be.
Do you get excited about challenges?
I love it.
Because I can't talk about the job, unfortunately, but I've been asked to go and look at an engineering project where they've been trying to solve it for 2 years.
Yeah.
And they said they couldn't, because it was an existing building and it's still being used when they build this huge, huge building on top of it. And they called me in for it. I was a subcontractor for someone else, and they called me in and he said, "Yeah, Andrew, you won't be able to solve this, but I just need someone to come in and have a look at it." Me and a person that works with me, I'm not going to take full credit, solved it in 20 minutes, 2 years, and they had over 100 people on there. And what I love it when people say, "You won't be able to solve this," absolutely. It excites the shit out of me. And people are like, "What's wrong with you?" Because there's so much risk in like taking these things on that people can't solve. But I always find it funny that what I see is such an obvious solution, people don't get. It's just a bit weird.
I think I think the world's getting to this really interesting point where I deal a lot with skills. So I used to run Accenture, used to run about a team of 160 people. We had all these skills and trainings and interesting stuff around it. And I think what people don't realise is the trick to a lot of success at the moment isn't necessarily just purely narrow focus on stuff.
Yeah.
I think actually, I feel like my knowledge is kind of a bit like a Venn diagram, as weird as that sounds. Mm. So I feel I've got these kind of circles of knowledge, and they're not necessarily things you'd get taught in school. It's, yeah. You know, common sense is one of those, or taking risks, I think, yeah. Or understanding which risks to take.
Yeah.
And I think people that overlap on lots of those circles in the right way have just huge advantage to be able to come up with these almost spontaneous way of solving problems, because you can suddenly turn around and you can take different bits of knowledge that wouldn't necessarily glue together, and you can do really amazing things with it. And I think, you know, I've definitely learned over the years that so much stuff is less well understood than people say. I think it's you know, as I've gone through management and all the place I've gone, I think I used to always look up when I was younger at teachers or everyone, and I used to think people knew what they were doing. And now I realize either they're lying or they're stupid, or they're able to admit they don't know what they're doing. And I think we're all as, you know, the first day you do something is the first day you do something. And I think, you know, being able to understand that actually you need to learn, and knowing how to learn, that's where the real skills come around at all, I think.
I do you know what? I'm so glad you've said that, because I keep saying to people, and this is only coming to me recently, is that you think people have their shit together.
Yeah.
And they don't. And I keep on telling younger people, because I have a lot of young people go, oh, you know, I'm under so much pressure to find out what I need to do with my life. Yeah. And I need to pick a career and a path and everything like that. And I was like, ask your parents what their plan is. I have this all the time. My parents are in their early 70s. My girlfriend's parents are in their early 70s. They're not dead yet. Ask them what their plan is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're as lost as 18-year-olds on what to do. And I said, don't get wrong, there are some people that have plans. I'm now I have a goal.
Yeah, same.
And I always go towards that goal. So yeah, I could tell you the direction I'll go all the way. I don't know what's going to happen in between, but I know where I need to get. And I think dyslexia gives you that overall view.
I totally agree. I always say to people that So having a goal is unbelievably important, because it's like if you've been drinking for a night out and you kind of, the pub chucks out, and if you've got no goal and you just kind of maybe we'll do this, maybe it definitely just mills around. But if you kind of think, okay, we're gonna go to a kebab shop, everyone all of a sudden, if you've got one shared goal, people just move there in one direction. And I think, you know, for me, it's really weird if I look at where stuff changed. It was probably about 27. I remember arguing with my then girlfriend, going, "Well, I'll show you that I can do stuff." And I then took a, and looking back, the goal I had is ridiculous. I thought, okay, I want to be the CTO of a tech company, and I'd really like to have a Porsche, and I'd like to have a yacht. And it sounds really, and like looking back, it seems crazy, and if I'm honest. And now I'm in a situation where I've got like a family car. My wife gets seasick, and I've turned down a load of jobs around that. But it gave me focus, and it meant that every time, I think people underestimate that, people romanticize life, and they feel that it's like a film, and people think, okay, it's like sliding doors, and one decision makes all the difference in your life. And I think actually, it's totally the opposite from that. Yeah. The thing that changes your life are all these small decisions that make up and turn you into you. And I think unless you have an overall goal and a direction, it's just very difficult to make all of those in a sensible, consistent way.
I've said that a million times in my life. It is made up of the small decisions.
It really is.
And if you don't know where you're going, you can't make them decisions.
Yeah.
And it's funny. You say about my goals are always things I always put in money terms, because obviously there is a money element of it. And I remember speaking to someone recently like, oh, well, a lot of the things you talk about are kind of either money or possessions and stuff like that. And I was like, no, what that does is that opens your mind, and then the other stuff comes out at the other end of it. I was like, if anything, through the last 7 years of my life where I've really started doing well, the thing I've been doing the best at is my relationship.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I've realized is I love being in the journey. And I know that's really cliche, and people say, oh, it's not about a destination, it's about the journey. It is about enjoying everything as it happens. Totally. Because I've had some real wake-up calls in my life where I've seen friends of the family that have had everything they wanted but were waiting until they retired in order to fulfill that. and they've died, and there's, you don't get that. And I think it's all about enjoying the moment you're in.
And I think, you know, if you pick it apart, sadly, the only thing at the end of the journey is death. I mean, like, I know that sounds really, really depressing, but, you know, I think there's so many people are striving to get to the next bit. And actually, this is all really fun. Like, I am so lucky, and I'm very acutely aware of how lucky I am that I've got into a career and a position where I enjoy what I do. And that is very rare. But I do think so many more people can achieve that. That's the thing. I, you know, the beautiful thing about the world is it is just not a zero-sum game. We can all do better. We can all grow the piece of the pie around it. And I'm finding more and more that's where I'm trying to push more of my life, because I just think it's, and it's something that, as weird as it sounds, something that I never had. So, you know, if I look back through my life, I would have done so, there's so many mistakes I've made along the way that if I'd just been able to ask someone or had that support, I think I would have done a lot better.
Yeah.
And so the more that I can try and help other people, or just even realize that it's okay to not know and it's okay to go through that, the better.
I kind of realized when I was younger, with all those things I kept on cocking up with dyslexia, I was similar, didn't know the alphabet at 12. It was like mind-blowing and stuff like that. I realized that. And then as I got older, I started doing things and people started asking for my advice. And I would give advice, but the advice I would give is advice I should take myself, but I very rarely ever did. So I kind of had an epiphany one day, like, why don't you talk to yourself as a separate person? And I do. And sometimes when I do things wrong, because I do things wrong all the time, I am definitely not perfect. I always end up going, Andrew, why the fuck did you do that? Like, that's not the right do. Or I'll be sitting there going, oh, I can't do this. I'll overthink things. And then I'll bring myself in and go, well, why are you overthinking it? Just do it. And then once I realised that, and that's obviously self-talk, like, I'm great at advice. People always come to me for it. But I was terrible at my own advice. But now I've kind of, that's what's changed for me.
And I think, the alphabet thing's really interesting, because I didn't realise until, and it sounds weird, until a year ago, when I started reading more books about dyslexia, because I think it's good to understand stuff that I kind of, you know, I had a dyslexic tutor when I was younger, but didn't do it for ages. I didn't realise that people can actually know the alphabet without singing the alphabet song. I know it sounds really weird. That was a revelation to me, that people can work out the order of letters within it. And I think it's really interesting of things that just, I thought everyone was doing the same thing as me and just singing this song out in their head. And actually, it turns out that people aren't. And I think the more that you can learn about how you differ, and I think, you know, neurodiversity is a fantastic thing, because I think we're going through a really interesting point in general life, where there's becoming so much more appreciation for the fact that actually, you know, neurodiversity is a really, really good thing. And I think companies are realizing it. I think people are realizing it, because I think fundamentally what you want is a spread of ideas. And the more you have this kind of, you know, this interesting evolutionary spread of ideas that sit around, the more occasionally you get these really interesting bits of brilliance and these bits that, you know, society moves on in jumps rather than a smooth curve.
Yeah.
So you want this mixture that sits.
Well, I think it's friction. I think we need friction in order to really prosper. It's, if we take it back to cavemen days or anything, it's only when problems arise do we create solutions. And in groups of people, when we have multiple people from different backgrounds and real diversity in different ways of thinking, do you create friction, and only then through that friction do answers really occur. And it's generally a thread through the podcast. This season is definitely about how if everyone thinks one way, then we don't win at all. We just have one direction, and that's not necessarily the right direction.
So I can't tell sometimes through my life whether the decisions I've made are related to, and I don't know the answer, because I can't see it from the side, whether some of the stuff I do is because I'm dyslexic or just because I'm bloody-minded, but it amazes me the amount, just to that point, you know, we've had big groups of people that have worked with me, and we've all kind of asked them what they want to do, and the amount of people that just kind of sometimes want to do the same thing. And I think really getting people who do want to break them, who do think differently, who do have opinion around it, who do want to, and I think that's, you know, that's how the world gets changed, by these unique combinations of people. And I think we really underestimate sometimes how much those individuals can change the world. I've got a good friend who said to me that, you know, if you look at like Back to the Future, for example, if the whole thing where they're going to go back in time and they're going to find one person, change the world, and no one really thinks, and not this is not me saying it's me, I'm by a long way, but people underestimate actually how one person doing the right thing and doing something differently, how much that genuinely changes the world. And we've got so much proof over the years, everything from, you know, the invention of stainless steel in a random accident by someone, which now means that now all of a sudden our cutlery doesn't taste of metal constantly, to, you know, there's all these interesting pieces where it's happened. And I think showing people that they can do that, and especially neurodiverse people, because if you want something, if you want an idea that's different from what's happening at the moment, what better way to find it from someone who's literally slightly wired differently? Like that seems like a really obvious thing to me. I think the problem is, there's been this approach called the tiger mother, which I think is probably one of my least favorite things, whereby this concept of early specialization and trying to teach your son or daughter to be the next Tiger Woods by just pushing him on one thing as hard as you can go.
Yeah.
And the reality is, I just think that's a really unsuccessful way of teaching people, because if you think about the context where it worked of golf, it's really easy with golf to stand there, hit a golf ball and see where it lands. And you can do that 100 times a day and you can roughly a bit of wind, but roughly see it. Because there's nice and there's simple rules to the game that you're playing and how it's working out. With all this crazy life, there are no rules. There's no path to go. There's no even sensible score system that sits around it. So people do better when they've got these interesting combination of skills from different area and different backgrounds. And that's one thing I'm very proud of Amazon. We're doing a large-scale reskilling. We're aiming to reskill about 80,000 people in the UK, move them into IT, because there is a lack of people doing tech at the moment. I mean, really is a lack of people doing tech. And I think taking people from different backgrounds is extremely, extremely powerful. And then more than that, not seeing the fact that you came into technology, you know, late as a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old, 60-year-old even, or older, but actually seeing it as you're coming into it with these wealth of possibilities. You know, you come, if you've come from the world of, say, for example, logistics, so you come from the world just, and you're not, it's not a negative that you've got these other skills. It's a really, really positive thing. And I think we've just over-specialized for too long. Mm. And I don't think that is the, I think rounded, interesting people who are aware of their skills are just worth far more. And I think the school system needs to adjust to that slightly. I think there's all kinds of interesting challenges as to how we fix that.
So yeah, and I completely agree. I look at schools, and I'm not going to blame teachers here, because they're very tight parameters where they can work in. But you're right. We kind of, if we take what you do, and like we just said, like AWS, no one knows what it is. But that's a flaw, isn't it? Because the opportunities are endless. And we've had people on from other industries, like the management side works from EY and stuff like that. And that is a business that if you go into a school and go, do you know what this is? People will go, the teachers will probably say no, because they haven't been subject to that world. I think the problem is, I always find with teachers, is they go to school, they stay in school, and once they've completed, they go back to school.
Yeah.
And the problem is, the real world is kind of a bit, it's not in the parameters of what they see.
I mean, at the moment, so computer science GCSE is now the 22nd or 23rd most taken GCSE. It's really, really low.
That's low.
It's really low, and it's getting worse. It's being taken by less students every year, and it's being taken by less girls each year as well, which is even worse. And if you look at entries into computer science at university, again, they're dropping year over year, and it seems almost unbelievable for me of what we're all doing. You know, I mean, everyone has a smartphone, everyone uses, and pretty much most people will use the internet, or people use technology as part of their life. And I think a lot of it is a real lack of understanding. And, you know, maybe partly this is the fault of business. It's a lack of understanding and explanation of the things that we do. You know, I am so lucky. My job consists of everything from working on big compute jobs for shops, to helping develop COVID vaccines, to help teach driverless cars to you know, help all kinds of crazy interesting, to help in the most interesting one, we've got flying air taxis that people are working on. And there's all of this is in this really interesting broad subject that is technology. And I think people don't quite realise what's into, and that can't be the right thing for the world.
So, Andrew, this is what we were talking about just before we rolled the beginning of the episode.
Yeah.
23rd most taken subject. I did computer science at school, and it was like super trendy. Cool. Everyone was doing it.
Yeah. I still don't know if I can really process that number, because it just seems ridiculous when that's the thing that we're all going to have to do. We're all going to have to be very good at that. And it's so low down.
It's kind of funny because in many ways, it's more useful in this day and age to be able to write code, for example, than it is to speak French. That would get me much further in life if I could write, well, not if I could, I can write basic HTML and CSS, and it's much more useful than being able to order a beer when I'm in Paris for my life.
I could probably order a beer in Paris, but I couldn't do the two things you've just done. So
whatever those words were.
Whatever you just said.
But coming up.
Yes.
You talk about lucid dreaming, of all things, and the importance of taking risks.
Yeah, it's really important that listeners know lucid dreaming isn't something inappropriate. After this episode, I spoke to a couple of people and they thought lucid dreaming was something it really isn't. So don't worry too much about that.
Well, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life, and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
But first, let's kick back off with a short anecdote about when a person asked Andrew, "Don't you think technology has had its day?"
Yeah, let's take a listen. Do you know what I had someone say to me quite recently, and it shocked the crap out of me, and you're going to love this. He come in, he's going to, I think, Cambridge to do engineering, and he said to me, we was talking about the future and what he wanted to do, and I'm very in trying to, like, say, have a plan and all the stuff we talked about. And I said, what do you want to do? And he went, oh, I don't know, I think I'm going to do mechanical engineering or something like that. But he said, do you think technology's had its day? And I'm not joking. I said, you can't be serious. I was like, you clearly don't know what's going on. And I sat there and talked to him because I love tech, love it. And we sat there and I talked to him about just a few of the things that's going on. And I said, and to be honest, we know 2%.
Yeah.
The general public knows 2%. You probably know a hell of a lot more than we do. But that's not being communicated. So the people coming into that workforce don't know the amazing things you're doing.
So that, and I think people have this view of if you go into IT, you're going to spend your days sitting behind a computer, coding away, and it's this very, you know, it's development and that's it. And, you know, I can code in different languages, but I'm not very good at it, if I'm honest. You definitely wouldn't pay me to do it. What I'm really good at is talking to people and understanding their problems and finding solutions to what they do. And, you know, before, if I take my early bits of career, effectively I was a system administrator, so we'd run systems, and it was kind of, as weird as it sounds, it was probably like an IT plumber is probably the best way of, or how I imagine plumbing being, if you join things together with pipes and you kind of work it out. And I think it's really sad because we're not necessarily eloquently expressing well enough to children and to returning people how good and how interesting some of these bits of their career are. And I think, you know, I think a lot of that starts not to moan about schools. I think schools have a really hard job. I think classes are way too big. You can't, I couldn't teach 30 kids. No way. Not in a million years. But I think from such an early age, we need to integrate computing and learning around technology and having fun with it. The thing that I find with all learning is people, so I'm rubbish at rote learning. So if you ask me to remember a list of something, I just can't do it. I mean, literally to a point, I mean, I really can't do it. But if you let me play around with something and you let me explore it, so, you know, even now, because, you know, I like still teach my stuff about tech. So I have all these projects that I'll do at home. So, you know, I built loads of robots that can do various things online because sometimes I want it to do things. I want it to check, for example, our local gym was really difficult to get crash slots. It sounds really random, but it was quite annoying. So my wife had to repeatedly check to get a crash slot. So I built a robot that would go off and find slots for it. I built a security camera at home and I hooked it up into Amazon Web Services and it can do facial recognition. It can tell me who's come into my house and where they're there. I've built my own personal version of Netflix and all of these things I'm proud of and I'm interested in. And I think the way that we teach people in schools and the way that people start to learn is it's just this, it's really boring. Like, I don't want to learn boring things. I want to build interesting stuff. And I think for whatever reason, we just in so many subjects, we just don't do that well enough. We don't show people how to have fun almost with it.
You're right. I think we're at a critical point now. And I always say this about my big thing, and actually I'd love your input on this because I may be talking absolute crap, but my understanding is that with AI becoming more of a thing now and starting to get traction, we're going to have a change. I don't think normal jobs are going to actually exist in the capacity they are at the moment. And with all the mental health issues we're having at the moment, it's all about, I believe it's a lot of it, not in all cases, by all means, a lot of it is fulfillment, growth, and stuff like that. And I think if we don't change the education system right now, what we're going to have is a lot of people not understanding where the world's going, not feeling their place and their purpose. But if we can, like you said, teach people that they should enjoy their job, because I have this where I wake up every morning and everyone always goes, oh, you're such a morning person. But that's because I generally love what I do. And it's not just what I do. And I keep saying to people this, you don't need to love your job. You need to love what you do in your job. So, and I say when I go through, so I really, when I started my life as a scaffolder, I loved being around people, doing the hard work. The hard work is what I loved. It was so hard. And then I was like, well, actually what I enjoyed was building things. So then I went to university, trained to become an engineer. And then I started understanding how building things work. And then as I started working in a business and growing a business, I realized the best building thing for me was building a business. And like, you don't need to go, right, I want to be a carpenter or I want to be in IT. There's stuff you can enjoy in each different one.
I totally agree. I mean, you know, picking that apart on the building side of it. So, you know, I used to just love tech, basically. I did love tech. And now what's weird for me is I feel like building businesses, I've started to treat it as the same as building a tech computer system, as weird as it sounds. And I find it's just so interesting because I find I'm taking those skills. I think the things I've learned earlier in my life, I'm adapting in a different way. I'm putting onto a different area, and it's really successful because of the way that I'm thinking about, which is really fun. I mean, on the AI side of things, I do think there's really interesting changes coming. So, you know, if I take driving related jobs, for example, so around 6-7% of the US are in driving related jobs at the moment. So, you know, that's either, you know, bits around logistics, actually driving taxis, driving lorries, all the things around it. You know, I see that autonomous vehicles are going to turn. I mean, like, you know, I came here in my Tesla today. It drove me down the motorway a lot of the time. They're getting unbelievably good now. And if I roll the clock forward, if I look in China, you have a company called Baidu. They've done about 9 million miles driving around Chinese city in completely autonomous vehicles. So when that comes in and when that hits, there are going to be lots of people that can't do the job they're doing anymore. That is, that's just the reality of it. And I think we do need to work out how to keep people happy and fulfilled, because fundamentally people want to, I do think people want to feel that they're productive members of society, that they're doing something that they can be proud of, whatever that thing is, something that they turn around and they go, yeah, I've built that wall, or I've painted that, or whatever it is. And I think we need to start to plan for some of that now, because, you know, I think it's amazing how quick technology can change, far quicker than it takes schools or governments or anyone to adapt. And I think that's something that we need to be very sure of what is happening in the future and trying to adjust our policies around that.
Yeah.
And trying to adjust the whole education system around it.
But I think the one of the main problems is, and this is me getting my soapbox here, is not actually education. It's a lot of it's media, because what we're taught to focus on as people is what's happening in the world in the negative term. Now, me and you have both talked about the positive side of stuff. And I think if the media constantly talked about innovations that's happening and the better side of what's going on, because let's face it, we can look at the world now and go, oh, it's a disaster, it's burning down, because that's what we're told to believe. Yet every day there's amazing things happening around the world, and people aren't really aware of that. So what people actually do is they come out of education and go, well, I've got to get a really stable job. And I don't even know what that means these days, because I, as a small business, everyone says to me, oh, you know, I don't know if I should go with you, because I need to know this certainty. Yeah. I know larger businesses that have failed more than smaller businesses. Yeah. It's like that sort of thing. But I think they're so worried about getting themselves in a good job, saving money, doing all this stuff, trying to tick the societal boxes. But if we actually promoted the amazing things that could happen to the world, this is why I am a massive fan of Elon Musk, because anytime he's put, every time someone puts a question to him, there's a very simplistic answer.
Yeah.
And it's always very positive.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like what we need to get out there more.
I totally agree. I think people have lost track of this mentality, that this growth mentality, that we can all make the world a better place. It is very easy to focus on some of the negatives that's happened. But actually, if you pick apart the really bad things that have happened in the world, so, you know, infant mortality, children dying is a very bad thing. Definitely.
Yeah.
We are now in a situation where that's lower than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
You know, that is if we look at poverty, like, you know, it's terrible. Some people do still live in poverty, and that is absolutely shocking. But if you look at the overall numbers around it, they're lower than ever before. Like, not everything is bad. And I think so much of life is trying to, you know, we need to show people the good that can happen from what they're doing. And I think, you know, especially when you have people who have, life is hard. Like, growing up dyslexic, growing up in, you know, not a great school, it's challenging. And lots of people going far, far worse situations than me in every way. And I think just showing everyone constantly the negatives, it makes people forget actually what they can really achieve. And, you know, people can do amazing things, and people will. That's the brilliant thing. I'm definitely, you know, if I'd say, why have I been successful? I think, as weird as it sounds, partly it's because I'm optimistic, and it's partly because I've got a really bad memory, because I seem to forget the bad things that happened to me.
Selective memory.
And it's really useful, actually. Yeah. It's very, very useful, because, and I think we need to encourage more people to see, it sounds overly trite of this look on the bright side, but actually to see the positives that exist within their lives and the world. And I think that's the way to bring success, honestly.
And I suppose life comes in these two ways of looking at things. You can look at things in negatives, and you can look at them in positives. And I always say there's a lot more positives than there are negatives.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. And I think, you know, life is about experiences. I think people underestimate, going back to the point earlier of life is a journey, I think it really is. And I think actually you want to experience interesting stuff. Like, you really do. Like people live lives where they don't, like, I am aware that I only have a certain amount of days left on this world, and then I'm off. And that's, don't particularly want that, but that is what it is. So in that period, we might as well enjoy it. There's so much fun. There's so much interesting things that I haven't seen and I haven't done yet. And I think one of the ways that I've probably done I'm happy with where I've got in my life. And a lot of that has basically been just trying things repeatedly, not worrying about failing. You know, I failed so many times, and I failed in, you know, I've gone for more job interviews than I could possibly name, to a point where I couldn't even tell you all the places I interviewed when I was young, when I was first getting into my career. You know, I then decided, actually, well, you know, just failing at all of this wasn't really helping me. So I started failing at job interviews and writing down why I failed it. And actually, it turns out that if you don't get upset and don't stress about failure, and you can try and learn from each time you fail, that's a really, really useful way. Because if I just fail one little bit less, actually failing less is the same as getting better. And I think, you know, you can go through really interesting points where you just gradually get better through it.
I think failure has been so important to me in my journey, and realizing that you can actually learn from it, because otherwise you don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things out there saying, oh, you can learn from other people's failures. You can, but there's nothing better than learning from a direct experience of failure. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I think that you have to take away, go, okay, I've done it at that time and that didn't happen. But what did I do well in that and badly? Let's cut out the badly and keep the well.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. It's funny what you say about the visualizations. I was trying to explain this to someone the other day, and the only one thing I could think of, I'm the same, so everything's visual for me. And I said, there's a scene in Matrix where he goes into the Matrix and he's learning about it, and he's standing in the white background, and then all the guns shooting and stuff like that. As every time they want something, it changes. Well, I was trying to explain, that's actually how I live my life. So when I'm thinking of a situation, like I could be sitting here talking to you now, and like I could remove all the background, the ceiling, bring in what I need to. So we could be sitting on a beach or in a, and that visualization allows me to do anything. And I have that. And the reason why I love structural engineering is because when I go to jobs, if they say, right, we're taking off the roof and we're going to increase it by 6 floors, as I'm watching it, it goes like the whole thing forms in front of me, and then I can really visualize. And I thought everyone could do that. I think that was my biggest learning. And people are like, what the hell are you talking about? Are you mental?
And then I have really, I'm not sure about yourself, I have really vivid dreams. I mean, like bonkers dreams.
So I lucid dream.
Yeah, same.
Right, and people find that bizarre. I literally can control anything in my dreams.
So I used to, when I was a kid, I used to have terrible nightmares all the time. So I used to
so did I.
Really bad. And then I suddenly realised that when I keep trying to explain it to Mike, I've got two daughters and a six-month-old son. And I've been trying to explain to my six-year-old that if you're dreaming, you can just kind of, how I started doing it, I just started to float. And so now, if ever I'm in a dream, I can just kind of, I can know I'm in a dream, and I can just float up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then once I float up a little bit, I suddenly like, oh yeah.
I can just do it. Yeah.
It's a dream. Yeah, it's fine. And then I'll literally fly out of that dream and then fly around. It sounds really, it sounds almost crazy, but I'll fly around in my kind of head dreamscape and then drop into where I want and have a dream about what I want for them. It's brilliant.
So that's exactly what I'm like. And I learned it because I used to have horrific dreams and I could start waking myself up. And apparently that's the first step to lucid dreaming. I didn't even know there was a thing where you kind of, you almost can train yourself to do it. So I used to go, oh, this is scary, I'm going to wake up, which apparently is a very strong trait in itself. Then I realised, even now, if something bad in a dream happens, I'm like, no, change this. And I can go like that, and the whole thing changes into a better environment. And it's like, I remember, so it started as the nightmares, and then I got to a situation where I stayed in the nightmares, and I always had something chasing me. So then I learned to fly, which I could never catch me when I fly. And I love sleeping. And people are like, why do you enjoy sleeping so much? And it's like, it's not like I sleep a lot, because I don't actually sleep that much. I'm always happy in the mornings because I've had a great night. Like, this is seriously.
And I think it's interesting. So, you know, so when I was at school, I had no dyslexic assistance at all. Not until, you know, I finally did when I was coming into my A-levels. And I got a little bit of extra time on my A-levels. And then I had extra time at university. But before this, when I was really struggling, my mum really tried to help me. So we got a dyslexic tutor. And I do wonder whether really vivid dreams are sometimes a... Is there something towards dyslexia in it? Because we talked through one of... she told me this really interesting story. So there was one of the people that invented... So if you imagine planes, so it's really bad if fuel leaks on a plane when it's on the runway, because obviously there's fires and there's all kind of interesting stuff. And I wish I knew the name of the person, but the story she told me was about a very dyslexic inventor who'd been working on this problem of, you know, how do we work out when a plane has a fuel leak when it's sitting on the tarmac? And he went to sleep, he had a dream, and he dreamed of a plane bleeding, bleeding because it was in pain. And then he actually took that idea from the dream. And then what they've done is in a lot of jet fuel, where they did at the time, I'm not sure they still did, but they did at the time, they added an additive that if it reacted with air, it turned bright red. So the idea was you could take it. And it's really interesting. And, you know, I will regularly wake up with these just really crazy ideas that I've run through my dreams, and I'll scrabble to my phone and I'll write down what it is before it disappears. And, you know, I do wonder if there's a link between the way that my brain works and that occurring. I mean, I don't know the opposite, but I think there's all kinds of interesting interplay between it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. If I go to sleep with a problem, I always wake up with a solution. And that's, my wife always says, why don't you go to sleep? You'll think about it.
Yeah.
And I always, the morning is always better. Like when obviously growing a small business, there's always a problem with cash flow and stuff like that. And it's always, I go to bed and I'm like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then when I wake up in the morning, there's a solution. I action it that day and then the problem goes away. And I kind of like, I think a lot of the time that's why it's so important for me to sleep. But now this is where we're coming to the future. I don't think there's, throughout our life, we've always had barriers to entry. You've got to look a certain way or be a certain person to get somewhere, right? Or you've got to know the right people. I think for the first real time in history, I think it's been a while, but definitely now, there is no barrier to what you can do. The barrier, I think, is only you. There's no person sitting there saying that you can't. You can't come down this path. And I think for the first time ever, you can go and manifest what you think about.
I could not agree more. I think we, through technology, we're coming. So I really like this concept of the democratization of technology. So you can go onto AWS. We'll give you a load of free credits. If you're a startup, we'll give you $100,000 just to get started for the first year, which is really cool, actually. Which is I genuinely think is cool. And I think you're getting into this point where you have all of these different services that you can connect together. And all of these different, everything from, you know, Fiverr online to you can buy services to podcasts to, you know, everything. And I think it's becoming easier and easier to kind of create your ideas. And, I think it's weird. If I look back when I was young, the thing I wish I'd done is I should have probably taken more risks when I was younger, as weird as it sounds. So
I feel the same.
Yeah. Oh, it frustrates me because now I've got, you know, a mortgage and I've got three kids and I've got like, sensible. But... Now, I'll never forget. So I used to work for Labbricks, which was just fun in many different ways. So I used to do a load of their IT, and we'd fight off Russian cyber hackers. That was just brilliant. We'd do all kinds of interesting stuff. And, you know, this is before the launch of the original iPhone. It'd been announced, and I sat down and went, oh, well, this would be really good to do gambling on. It'd be fantastic to do gambling. I sat down and I prototyped out a really simple version of blackjack that you could do on this, like, iPhone simulator. And I thought, this seems like it's a really good idea. And I talked to the chap that was then the CTO of Labbricks, who's a good friend of mine still. And I said, you know, I think we should do a mobile game so people can gamble on their phone. And he turned around to me and said, no one's ever going to gamble on their mobile, John. Like, that's never going to work. And I still kick myself about the fact that if I'd just gone off and done that, it would have been. But and I think that's, you know, that's the weird thing that I think, you know, I think things like this, like podcasts like this, I think having mentors within life, I think having people almost like no one had ever that until then. I don't think anyone had ever given me the permission to go off and do things, as weird as it sounds. And I think now I feel like I've hit my stride because I am in this weird situation where I feel I'm free to invent and create and move stuff. And I think, you know, getting to a point where people feel like that from an earlier age is just a really beneficial thing, because, you know, the incredible stuff that they'll create as a result of it, it's just worth it for all of humanity. I really think it is.
Oh yeah, and I think the key point is trying to free people from the concept of what life should be.
Yes.
I think if we stopped, I mean, there's a lot of issues obviously around people comparing themselves to others. I think that's a big issue. But worrying what people think is another problem. But I think if we can free ourselves from... See, I always say to people who want to start businesses, I say, just do it. You know, don't get wrong, I don't think everyone's good for starting a business. I think some people are suited for it. But I tell people to go for it. But don't worry if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because people's biggest worry when they're starting a business isn't normally, like you would think, oh, I'm going to struggle financially. That's never anyone's worry. It's actually, if it goes wrong, what would everyone think of me? What would my family say? What would my friends say? If we supported each other a lot more in these endeavors, like I remember someone says, let's stop throwing, I can't remember who said it, so I'm not going to take any credit for it. Let's stop throwing each other baby showers. Why don't we throw each other business showers? You know, but we don't. In fact, when I said I was starting a business, everyone went, ooh, why would you do that? Like, and do you know what? Anyone that comes to me for advice says, oh, the negativity I've got around going out and doing something, it's unbelievable. Yet when people make it, and make it could be deemed in anyway, it's not just financially. Like if someone makes it into the newspaper because they've created this great thing, and their family's like, oh, well, it was all right for them. They were lucky. It's like, it's just this kind of negativity around it.
I think, I think it's really helpful, or at least it helps me. I like to think I take calculated risks in the things that I do, but I will definitely play out in my head what is the worst that could happen, like really the worst. Like I still get really nervous doing, but I do public speaking a fair bit. But I still get really, really nervous doing it. Like I think there's certain things that I'm never going to get less nervous about, and public speaking is one of them. So it just is what it is. And now I'll go into things like that and I'll think, well, what is really the worst that could happen? I could, you know, maybe collapse on the stage or like, you know, say something I'm really, but none of it's, and even if I did that, nothing really that bad is going to happen for it. Like I think we're very much overly, we play out all of these terrible risks and these things that we think might happen. But actually when you really kind of push it even further and think, well, even if the worst of the worst happened, well, my wife will still love me. My kids won't even notice, quite honestly. I mean, I'll come home and they'll think it's exactly the same. So it doesn't. So we can take risks through it. And I think, you know, playing out the, I think it's good for people to almost experiment with their fears of what is bad and what is good. Because I think the more that we can have this rounded view about life and take that into account, the more that we can go off and try interesting things.
So what would you say your invisible gift is?
I think I'm very good at picking things up. I've got a way of, I think I've got a kind of, as weird as it sounds, I've got a knack of picking things up and working out how things work, and about kind of, I like really like knowing how things work, and that's everything from, you know, like I really like material science, or I like knowing how the light works, or I like understanding the protocol that runs between the two computers, or how a business functions. And I've kind of, because now, at first, that's a really hard thing to do, and you can only learn one thing, as weird as it sounds. But because for whatever reason, I remember all these individual how things work. It probably is from being a kid, if I'm honest. I used to love, there was this pop-up book called How Things Work, ironically, that would show the inside of machines. And I think over the course of my life, I've just picked up more and more of these understandings how kind of everything works. And then, so everything I see new, I feel it's easier because I can look back and I can say, well, actually that thing is kind of the same as that. And so I've got this brilliant combinatorial effect of understanding how things tend to work together. And then hopefully using that to do interesting stuff with it. And I think part of that is the visual side of dyslexia, definitely. You know, I genuinely want to change the world. There's stuff that we're working on at the moment that can genuinely change the world. And I'm really lucky to do that by just kind of working out how everything works together.
I think that's brilliant. And from my point of view, it doesn't just work on things, because my parents were the first people. I was the first family I knew to have a computer.
Yeah.
I was also the first family I knew to get rid of the computer because I took it apart and didn't know how to put it back together. and which my mum and dad were not very happy with and still tell everyone to this day they spent all this money on a computer and I took it apart. I was very fascinated with microchips. It blew my mind how they worked. But then I actually realised that not only could you do that with things, you could do that with people. It works on all levels. Yeah. And I think that's an amazing trait to have. And thank you for letting me breaking you down today, which cool. has been great. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew, what an episode. John is a phenomenal guy. If you had to describe his invisible gift, how would you explain it?
Well, I think there's too many sides to it, but he's what. First of all, let's not beat around the bush. He is a fantastic speaker. Like he's so laid back. In fact, I better watch my podcast position. You might be replacing me with him.
Well,
and secondly, he's just like, he's got the same view as I have that there's no problems you can't solve, and if anything, there's always a way out of it. So no matter what comes your way, there's always a way to solve it.
Yeah, I think his desire to understand how you can break things down and how something works is amazing. And that is absolutely connected to his neurodiversity. And I think that really is an invisible gift. With that in mind, do you think we should be encouraging more young people to diversify their skills or to specialise in one field?
I think diversifying is really important. As we spoke about, it's you never know where you want to go and work. You need to start somewhere and move into directions that work for you. And having a broad understanding of things actually really helps you with that. I think we need to niche in our understanding, but be broad in our experience. I think that's the best way we can do it.
I think that's great advice. And I think especially for neurodiverse people, especially if they're just coming out of school or education, that broad experience of different stuff can really help them. Just going back to John for a second, the other thing that really stood out for me was his really positive outlook and how exciting the future of technology still is. I mean, I know we were talking earlier on in the episode about technology having its day, but it has just begun, hasn't it?
Yeah, and this is something I really stand by. I get asked a lot, and I'm not even in technology, but I understand the power of it because it's done so much for me. And like I said, we're just in the early stages of it. But I think what we have as a society to work towards now is everyone understanding the future of technology and where they fit into it, because things are going to change, but that doesn't mean it's going to be necessarily bad. But it certainly needs to be expressed more by tech companies about what's going on so people can get ready for that.
So if you want to learn more about John, be sure to follow him on LinkedIn. Just search for John Hammond. I'm sure if you mention the Invisible Gift podcast, he will be more than receptive. Next week on the show, Andrew, you're sitting down with Benjamin Cook from EY to discuss the groundbreaking report that he's authored, and apparently it really shines a light on the true value of dyslexia.
Yeah, this is really exciting for me because I purposely wanted Ben on to talk about this because that report changed dyslexia in the workplace, and EY is one of those corporate organisations that actually make big changes. They're always the tester of structures in business, and you know, whatever they do, most businesses normally follow, so they are a trailblazer for that sort of work. And Ben himself, dyslexic, has done amazing things, and that report, which I've read a few times, obviously I had to reread it, I am dyslexic. yeah, it was a great report and I just needed to read it.
Well, that should be a great conversation which you're having this week.
Yep.
And we'll be back next week to talk about it and understand a bit more, go through it. Thank you for listening to The Invisible Gift. Make sure to follow the podcast so you do hear when new episodes are released. You can write to Andrew if you'd like to share how you have managed to uncover and use your neurodiversity, your invisible gift, If you have any comments about the show, you can do that by writing to him, andrew@theinvisiblegift.com is his email address. You can also check out the website, theinvisiblegift.com. And I think that just leaves us to say thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
See you next week.
See you next week.
Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.